Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Griese! Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to get in the game.
And hello once again. This is Coach Chuck Griese, and it's another week of American Tennis. And folks, thank you very, very much as we've gone into our fifth year now on the UR Tennis Network. And folks, you can go back and get our every program. If you go to chuckcreasy.net, you can hear all the programs. You can also check out on the UR Tennis Network on your phone or on your computer. Look for Lisa Stone's Parenting Aces. Also, folks, look for John Denise's Florida Tennis Connection. And thank you, J.P. Weber, for picking up the UR Tennis Network. And while you're thinking about it, go to WeCoachTennis.net, J.P. Weber's website. That Facebook has over 2,000 people on it now talking about tennis. It's pretty darn good. But we're going to move on. We've got a great program today, and I really want to use the majority of time letting the individual that I have here speak with you. But we've got Robert Davis, and if there is a more accomplished coach out there who's done as much, I'd sure like to see him. But Robert has been coaching now on the professional and ATP tour for 26 years, and that's quite a long time to do anything but to be traveling around the world and to be inspiring people wherever he goes. Beside being on the pro tour for 26 years and having his own players out there and helping players win tournaments, he's also been the national coach of six different countries, including Peru, Panama, Thailand, Indonesia, Myanmar, and I believe he's worked a lot in Singapore as well, and Thailand, of course, and he's responsible for a lot of wonderful things happening in Southeast Asia with tennis. But we're just really glad to have you, Robert, here on the program today. I mean, 20 years also as a tennis writer, that speaks volumes. Now, folks, you can, Robert's written a wonderful book on Assam Qureshi, who was runner-up, one of his players, runner-up U.S. Open in 2010. But he also has a book in the works right now. When it comes out, I think it's going to be a big hit. That's all I'm going to tell you about it right now. But he also writes for Deuce Tennis Magazine on the ATP Tour. He writes articles, and you'll see his name out there a lot. But really has just done a tremendous amount of things. You can look at his work at robert-davis.net, robert-davis.net. So with all that, I'm just glad to have you here in our little makeshift studio here today, Robert. And, you know, the biggest thing, I've always said that there's probably only about five ways you make a living in tennis if you're not going to be a professional player. But in coaching, you either be a college coach like I've done most of my life, you can be a club coach, you can be a junior development training coach, you can be a tour coach, which you have been, or you can be in the tennis industry. Now, you've picked playing, you know, being a tour coach, and you've spent most of your life now, over half of your life, traveling the world, and as exciting as that sounds, can you sort of give us a little bit of background how you got into that? And then we definitely want to talk about the mentoring you've been doing. So thanks for being on the program.
Thanks, Coach. Always fun to come back and talk with you about tennis and sharing ideas. With getting on the tour, thankfully, we work in an industry where just about anybody can say that they're a coach on the tour. You can be a former college teammate, a brother. It's really easy to get in the door. But once you get in the door, there's always you've got to be able to make it and do it. And I was very lucky to have grown up under the apprenticeship system, having worked for you, Coach, and then also Dennis Vandermeer, which opened a lot of doors and gave a lot of opportunities.
Well, I know, but you had to get your start somewhere. But again, I often think for myself, it's tough, as glamorous as it sounds, traveling. You've been in over 50 countries now, and with tennis, and I mean, you've been on every continent, I believe. You've been, is there any continents? Oh, I guess Antarctica.
Well, the tennis tour is, it's sort of like being on the, you know, rock tour. You know, you travel all over the world. You get picked up at airports. You stay in nice hotels if you're on the ATP. But even on the Challenger and Futures, it's really can be really exciting if you're a person who likes to travel to exotic places. And you get caught up in that. You know, but I'll never forget the best advice I got when I was starting out was you get a job to do a job, not to keep a job. And the best I've seen a lot of young coaches come on the tour, and some of them make it and some of them don't. But if you realize that you get a job to do it and not just to keep it, then that automatically gets you in the right direction.
Yeah, and everybody thinks that you become instantly famous and instantly rich. And a long time ago, I had my mentor, Harry Hopman. I got to work for him a little over a year, and I think it was the best experience I ever had in my lifetime. I remember the joke used to be when you work for Mr. Hopman, it was room, board, and experience. But at the same time, that was the most valuable and the most, forget price, forget cost. It was the most valuable time that I think I ever spent in just being able to learn. And people surely underestimate that.
Sure. I couldn't agree with you more on that, Coach. I've met quite a few people who worked under Harry Hopman, coaches, and Bob Brett comes to mind. And, you know, that room, board, and experience principle works great because over the years, the assistant coaches or young coaches that I've seen, they're willing to sacrifice, they're willing to learn, they're willing to ask questions from the veteran legend coaches. And Danny Valervidou comes to mind. Danny was the best friend of Andy Murray in Barcelona. He went on to become his sort of day-to-day coach, but when Andy brought in Yvonne Lindell, Danny could have gotten angry and he could have pouted, but instead he took it as an opportunity to learn from Lindell, And for about a year and a half, he did just that, and he did a tremendous job of learning from a legend. And then after that, Danny was able to get a job working with Thomas Berdych. And it's a good example of a young coach who realized that he needed to learn and then was able to translate that into another coaching job later.
Well, while we're speaking about that, earlier you had reminded me, and we were talking about, you asked me what my favorite thing is. One of my favorite things is the amount of players or assistant coaches that I've had that have gone into coaching. And that really is the thing I'm most proud of. But you were talking about that young fella and his father that you coached back in Peru, Cesar.
Yeah.
But that's a great story. Can you tell that story? Would you mind? I don't think he would mind at all here.
Cesar Castañeda, he came, worked for me in Peru. He got his first job working with me. And then he wanted to go to America. And he came and he took a bus from Miami to Clemson. He did summer camps with you.
I don't know. He made. I don't know what he made.
But didn't make much money. But anyway, long story short, Cesar really wanted to be a coach on the tour, and he went down and he got in with Kei Nishikori when Kei was 14, and Kei wasn't anybody big down at Balotelli's. And so Cesar spent 4 years as his travel coach. Did a wonderful job with Kei until he moved on, and then Cesar did the similar thing, went and did an apprenticeship with Bob Brett at Tennis Canada. And then he got spent 2 years with Milos Raonic as the tour coach for him in the juniors and futures. So the apprenticeship system works great. But, you know, I always felt like young coaches, they need to have that in their DNA. They need to know that they be willing to sacrifice and learn from the legends before they try to make money out of coaching. Coaching is a passion, not a transaction. It's not about making money. It's about making a difference.
I'm writing down my own notes because these are quotes I want to remember. The coaching is a passion. It's not a transaction. And that's, you know, I remember I was in my 20s and I was thinking about, do I go into basketball coaching? Am I going to do tennis? And then I was so heavily influenced by Harry Hopman that I said, wow, we can do the tough basketball methods in tennis as well. Wow, these guys are the greatest athletes in the world. I got to see some of the great athletes. And the best tennis players are just, they're great, great athletes. And I said, my golly, if I could do that. But my mother said something very wise. She said, son, in your 20s, try to learn. 30s, you invest your learning. In 40s, you'll try to start making some money. But she said, write everything down and then cross out money. She said, you're not going to starve. You're not going to ever make enough in your 20s, she said, to ever save it and get anything of value. You cannot save enough in your 20s. You're just trying to get things started. She said, so cross out money and make the decision based on that and how wise that is. I wanted to ask you, as you started traveling, my golly, I think you've probably had some highs and lows as far as paychecks and non. Have there been some rough times out there where you just said, hey, listen, maybe I shouldn't do this?
No, gosh, everyone knows you don't get into coaching for the money. You could make a lot more money at some fancy country club, teaching by the hour, teaching ladies to do doubles drills. But you get into coaching because you like the arena, you like the competition, you like seeing the young guys progress. And so when you're a young coach and you're winning, you think you got the special magic and, you know, you think you just have to wave a magic wand over the player. But as you get older, you go through a period where you start developing more questions than answers. And then eventually you get to a point as a coach where you get a little bit wiser, and then you see the behavior patterns of players and you have enough that you're able to give sound advice. But you keep it short. Because as we all know, on pro coaching, there's no one-size-fits-all. Coaching at its best in tennis is a philosophy, and it's up to the player and coach to find the right philosophy that works for them.
Okay, talk about that a little bit. A philosophy, which means?
Well, there's, for example, you've got, let's take the top four, Tony Nadal with Rafa, Roger Federer, Novak, Andy. Tony Nadal has said over and over that his philosophy of coaching would not work with Roger nor Novak nor Andy. what worked. Peter Lundgren, who coached Marcelo Rios to number one, Roger Federer to number one, Marat Safin to number one, and then he had Stan Wawrinka, was able to adapt to each different player. And I think the great coaches do that. They have their basic philosophies, but they also adapt, and they're willing to communicate with the players and meet the players. The younger the player, the more firm the coach is. But as a player gets older and more established, coaches need to be able to listen just as much as talk.
Well, you know, the communication, you look at any of the pro sports, you always, don't you wonder if you're, whether it is Billy Donovan, who just jumped from University of Florida to, I think he coaches Oklahoma City now, the basketball team. And you go from really more of an authoritative, I don't hate to say authoritative, but you've got to go from there to coaching these millionaires. And, you know, the story is always, well, who's running the show there? And I think it was easy to see that, you know, a doggone Pat Riley was pretty much old school with all of those guys, and he was able to make it all work. And you've got these high-paid guys with big egos and everything. And then on the pro tour, you'll see situations where somebody's coaching someone and then the player fires them. I mean, well, what is the balance? Has that been a hard thing to...
No, I mean, the first thing is tennis is unlike any other sport. The player normally pays the coach. So, you know, basically you're getting paid to tell the boss what he's doing wrong. So that's a unique thing in tennis, and that's part of one of the biggest problems we have in coaching on the professional, even on the ITF junior level, is the coach doesn't want to risk losing the job. So instead of telling the player what he needs to hear, he tells him what he wants to hear. And so then you lose the respect of the player, but you don't do the job. You end up just trying to hang on.
Right, and that's really an important thing at every level. That's I've seen coaches in college that buckle and just try to keep their players happy. In the end, it never works. It never works. Players want coaches. I always come back, Robert, and I will say I've never had a player ever come back and say, you were too hard on me, and I hated the hard work we did. They always will come back, though, and say, why didn't you stretch me more? Didn't you see the potential I had? Why didn't you tell me what I needed to hear instead of what I wanted to hear? That's the biggest thing. I think anybody listening out there that wants to be a coach or is a coach, you have to be the boss, but you have to be the boss and deliver messages sometimes with blows, but you mainly deliver many, many messages without blows. I always say with the strong-willed athlete, you mold the will, never break the spirit. It's not about you. And in the end, that race car has to run. They have to be able to function with their mind right and everything right. But it is probably the hardest dynamic to work with, wouldn't you say?
Yes, well, there's a progression. If you're starting with a player, you need to do your due diligence before the first practice. Roger Rashid, who coached Leighton Hewitt, Gail Monfils, Tsonga, and Grigor Dimitrov, has a system where he has a little contract with non-negotiables, and the non-negotiables are attitude, hustle, effort, scheduling, different things like that. So he's very clear and upfront before they even go on the court for the first hit, what's expected of him, what's expected of the player. And they have areas that they're not allowed to, as he calls them, non-negotiables. You can always start off too strong as a coach and relax, but you can't start off weak and get stronger. Players are like racehorses. They can tell when the jockey is confident or when he's weak or when he's timid. And coaches who start off trying to appease the player never last.
Right, and that is a lot to say there. So could you imagine, you know, and you see this, but so therefore you have to be willing to go to battle with the player at the right time, in the right way, and deliver the messages without delivering blows. Sometimes you have to deliver, you know, metaphorically, you have to deliver the blow that gets them to wake up. Many, many years ago, I heard the quote of Tom Landry, and again, it was pro football, but he said the coach's job is to get people to do things they don't want to do in order to have things they want to have.
Well, that's so true, and, you know, a lot of the stuff that I'm saying today, Coach, it's not new, original for me. It's from other coaches that I've heard, but, you know, the big thing is starting out is you ask the player, what does he expect of you as a coach? And you get it out, what does he want? Does he want someone who carry the bag and just be a friend and have meals? Or does he want someone to make him better? And making him better often is uncomfortable because there'll be a lot of times where you have constructive criticism sessions and you say, you know, and every day you're telling the player he's either, you know, not moving his feet or not doing this or a service. You're giving him a lot of critique, and he has to be able to accept that. And if he doesn't want to accept it, he needs to tell you up front, and then you know where you stand.
Right, exactly. I mean, and that's the hardest thing, but there's no way. I think the biggest point you made, it's like I was trained to be a high school math teacher, and I remember as I was doing my student teaching, the teacher who I was under kept saying, you can always get easier later, but you cannot get tougher. Don't you dare start out too easy and try to be all the kids' friends.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest mistakes you see on the tour, especially, you know, the younger coaches and even sometimes the coaches who've been out there for a while, they get flattered when a player comes up and says, gosh, I'd like for you to work with me. And so, you know, they like the idea that players probably got a higher ranking than where they're at or there. They think that this could be really something good. So they start off on the wrong foot by wanting the job so bad that they're not willing to lose the job in the interview. And you've got to be willing to, if you can't just take it because it looks like a better job or a higher ranking. You've got to make sure that you're the right fit. And you also have to be willing to lose the job in the interview process to stick with your principles.
And every, by the way, what I know about coaching is that every good player out there wants that coach who allows themselves to be vulnerable as well, because that you become great at anything you do. Any tennis player worth their salt allows themselves to be vulnerable every time they go out on the tennis court. And as a coach, you realize that as well. So let me jump here real quick. So you were a coach who became a tennis writer. Mm-hmm. Now, I know, and I hate to say, I know your brilliance. I know your good Lord gave you a lot as far as your perspective on things. And an incessant reader, writing, the depth that you look at things, folks, I marvel at the depth that I get to go to when I speak to this wonderful man. But Coach, to talk about the writing, has this always been a passion? And was tennis a vehicle to get to write, or is writing a vehicle to do tennis? Sort of, how is that mixed in?
Well, thanks for the kind words, Coach. Well, the writing in tennis is always something that's been fascinating because there's so many dramas out there, so many stories that, you know, the mainstream press only really covers the top 10 players. So, you know, we hear about, you know, them all the time. But, you know, there's so many stories of players overcoming obstacles, overcoming things that they even put in their way, whether it's on the futures or challengers. So it's always been fascinating to me to do these interviews and get to know them. But from the coaching standpoint, the writing has been tremendous help for me to continue my education, because every player profile I do in talking with their coaches, you see that there are different methods of coaching and different methods of getting a player to do, as you said, what he needs to do to have what he wants. So it's just been a great education to be able to research and study and hear how players have done it and to realize that there's no one way to coach a player.
And, you know, the writing, has it branched off into other things other than tennis writing, or pretty much that is the...
Well, as it relates to tennis, it's given opportunities to do deeper projects. One of the projects that working on with Mike and Bob Bryan on the not only their story of how they made it, but how other doubles teams made it and the intricacies of doubles. So that's been a really good project of how good parenting with good plan, then you need the kids like Mike and Bob to execute the plan, and then how they've stayed humble and given back to the game. It's their story is a wonderful story.
I think their story is about the best we've had in the United States of America. Robert, I'm going to say this.
Yes,
I do not know a better story in the United States of America history of tennis. I mean, if you look at a Stan Smith, fantastic story. If you look at an Arthur Ashe, oh, my God, a fantastic, with Dr. Johnson, a fantastic story. But Bob and Mike Bryan are world record holders in their craft. But it's the way they have done it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Having spent a lot of time with them on and off the court, is they didn't luck into it. Nothing was given to them. They've earned everything. But in addition to their results, what makes them, in my opinion, so special is how they've honored the game. They're always giving back to the game. They're never too proud to go out and hit with young kids. They don't wait for Kids Day or the ATP to ask them. They're constantly giving back. But on the backside, if you could see the way they practice when nobody's watching, and as Bob Bryan once told me, it's what you do behind closed doors that determines what type of person and player you are. And I just can't say enough about what good people and not just good players that the Bryan brothers are.
Yeah, I'm the only thing I'm disappointed about is how we have diminished the importance of doubles over the past 10 years. And this is primarily, most people don't understand why, this is primarily a monetary thing, isn't it, about the tour promoters and everything. Could you explain very quickly why doubles has been diminished from that standpoint?
Well, there's a few reasons, but in a nutshell, you've got tournament owners who want to lower cost. So obviously, if they get rid of the double specialist, they have less hotel rooms to pay for, less matches with umpires and referees. That's what their feeling is, that not many people are going to – they don't get enough crowd support, and they don't – double matches don't sell tickets unless singles players involved. There are two ways to look at it. That's one, their version. On the other side, we know worldwide more people play doubles than singles. The players, and many of them feel rightly so, that there hasn't been enough effort to promote the doubles and promote them in events. They haven't been used in the right way. And we just saw yesterday, or 2 days ago at Cincinnati, the ATP event in Cincinnati, Wayne Bryan led the double showdown and got all the top doubles players out on the court and did a pro-am and did a wonderful event with seniors and juniors in Cincinnati. He also does a wonderful event in Indian Wells in Miami. And then we can see the results of promoting doubles and how it fills up the stadium when they play. And so I think the tournament owners need to take a lesson from Wayne Bryan and start promoting doubles more and using these players rather than just putting them on the back courts.
Can I throw an idea in there? And if you ever have this a chance, tell me if this would work. I've always believed the owners could have what they want, the doubles could be promoted, and everything could work well if they would start the tournament, if they could, on a Sunday or a Monday. They do two rounds of doubles out of the blocks. Monday, Sunday after evening, and Monday are doubles promotion days. You give your free tickets, bring your school kids in and everything. You do that. Well, what happens if you could do two rounds to start out the tournament? Then what would happen is a couple things, I believe. First of all, if you're the tournament owner, three-fourths of the draw is done. You don't have to take care of anybody except the final four or the final eight teams, depending on the size of the draw, whether it be 64 or 32. Number two, you promote, and these guys are doing pretty much what golfers do on Tuesday and Wednesday when they do the pro-ams and those things to promote. Number three, if I'm Roger Federer or if I'm Rafael Nadal and I want to get warmed up for the tournament, what better way to warm themselves up for the tournament than to go in there and play doubles first and you get into the tournament? Even at junior tournaments, folks, even at junior tournaments or other tournaments, think of the camaraderie, the brotherhood, the sisterhood. just the general welfare of the communication that is done and the relationships that are made in the first 36 or 48 hours of a tournament. So I really believe it's a scheduling issue. Then you bleed in the last 9 matches or the last 5 matches, whatever it might be, into the tournament. Where am I not seeing something, Coach? What am I not seeing, or would that work?
Well, I think they have a lot of meetings on the ATP with the player council and people getting different ideas. And I think all ideas and all whether out of the box or in should be considered. And there should be dialogue, and tournament owners should be able to have some creativity with their tournament with doubles. Otherwise, if doubles doesn't, the doubles players also have to realize that they have to meet the tournament owners more than halfway. Otherwise, they're going to be a dying, die out. So I think all options should be considered, and then also see, but there needs to be more dialogue between the owners and those who are passionate about doubles.
Well, okay. I agree, and I think one of the worst things, I don't want to go there at all, but the NOAAD scoring has diminished it instead of increased the depth of the game. It has diminished the importance of it, and it's just a horrible thing. But look, we've got to go to commercial, and I want to go into how does a young person, what should they do to get into coaching? I want to talk definitely about your other projects. There's some fantastic things, folks. Go from killing fields to tennis courts, Cambodia, and see what Mr. Robert Davis, and what is the name of your the man there has done so much in Cambodia? Riti Tep, and find out what they have done. And I think a man like Leander Pays was there to help you promote tennis and stuff. And some of the things that you're doing in these countries are just fantastic. And with a couple breaks in the athleticism there, I've been in Southeast Asia. What wonderful athletes. I think a lot of things happen. We want to talk about that and some other things. And again, if you want to call in, call area code 714-583-6853. 714-583-6853, and we will be right back with American Tennis.
This is Coach J.P. Weber of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. In my 30 years experience in coaching tennis, I've never seen a better tennis training situation for children than Coach Creasy's Total Tennis Training Camps. Chuck Creasy has coached them and trained them in every arena from juniors to collegiate to professional tennis, and over 15,000 children have improved their games at his summer tennis camps. Find out more at ChuckCreasy.net. That's ChuckCreasy.net.
Folks, this is Coach Chuck Creasy, and camp is over. However, go to my website, chuckcreasy.net, and read my blogs. And, folks, I'm always writing, and I'm always trying to come up with some solutions to issues that are out there with tennis. So stay up, and you'll find out about our performance camp that we're going to have over the Christmas period and camps next summer. Also, I've got my books and other things on there, but look at ChuckCreasy.net.
Breaks his heart.
making them in America, and we make them the old style way of meat and potatoes, and we add the spices when we can. And Coach Robert Davis, I use some of your quotes about the meat and potatoes, and I think we are really good at the spices here in the United States. We've got the fluff, we've got the gimmicks, we've got the gadgets, we've got the equipment, we've got the dartfish, we've got the red, orange, green ball, and we've got the special, everything's special, but we're not making a lot of champions. And to be quite frank, if you take out Andy Roddick, which won the last Grand Slam champion on the men's side was 2002, I believe. That's been 15 years or 60 tries. We have no U.S. Open men, U.S. men winning. If you take if you take him out, it's been probably 20 years or more. Serena, if you take her out of the ballpark, and Venus, it would be probably Lindsay Davenport. And I'm saying, we really, with everything we have and all the resources, have we got too much fluff, not enough tough, not enough of the right stuff? I mean, what do you see out there? Just a quick answer, what you see. Too much spices, not enough meat and potatoes?
Do you mean for American players?
For American players. Why aren't we? We're making them in America here. You've been all over the world, but our champions, look, our champions are from where? Serbia and
well,
where?
I think
where
you've got some players that came out who could have, maybe it's Steve Johnson is one that I really like a lot.
I love what he did.
Yeah.
By the way, did you know that he went undefeated his last 2 years?
I did know that.
At UFC, he learned how to win. He probably would have taken 15 to 20 losses with no ad scoring, and he didn't even lose. So.
Well, you've got Steve Johnson, who's done well. You have a lot of players who – Paul Goldstein was another. You've had quite a few very promising players. I know the young guy that you worked with, Francis Tiafoe, is another good one coming up. I think something happens and when they get on the tour and they get close to 100 or 150, they sort of get on these – they get sponsored by the association and they're out there, and then it becomes a little bit too comfortable. I'm not blaming the player, but the situation becomes, and then they're not responsible for the hotel rooms or the flights, and you know, it sort of becomes just a job. Whereas, you know, if I compare America to Argentina has no structure. Their federation doesn't support a single player, and the Argentines, they're probably the best known and respected for their competitiveness and fight, not for their technique. Not for the way they look on the court, and yet, you know, they've won. Del Potro, Gaston Gaudio, they've done really well. But something happens in them with the American players once they get to that 50 to 100 level. Now, John Isner has done great to stay in the top 20. Sam Querrey's coming back, but maybe it's the comfort zone.
People want to be comfortable. They don't want excellence as much. And coaching 101, I've always said, your best players, you must work them the hardest. You must overturn every stone trying to get everything out of them because, you know, the curse is to have a great talent and not to develop it, you know. But I think we do it in reverse. We are the toughest. We baby the best players, and we are toughest on the others.
Well, but, I mean, you're asking a question that's no different than what the French have to ask themselves. The French, with a much smaller population, continuously turn out the best juniors in the world, but they haven't won a Grand Slam since 1983, despite having the best juniors year after year. But there are a lot of similarities between the French players and the American players, which are great talent, a lot of support, but yet underachieved. But the French just have to go next door to Spain to see a complete difference. No support. They don't have the best juniors, but yet they've been dominating tennis with Davis Cup and Grand Slams. Ferrero, Moya, Costa, all of those before Rafa Nadal took over. So what is Spain doing right that France and America is not?
the mentoring looks like a big one.
And the training is a lot tougher.
And, you know, that's where I'm afraid that we're going to get to with all the abbreviated scorings and the shortened matches and trying to make things comfortable instead of tough. And by the way, if it's not tough, we're going to lose our best athletes because the best athletes want to be pushed. One quick question, and then I want to go to your the projects you've had and the things you've done in Cambodia and other places. How, if I'm a young coach listening to the program today, how to get into coaching? If I want to get into travel coaching or get into coaching?
Well, obviously, the route most followed to get into travel coaching is to go to a place that has players who are pro players or top juniors, and then you work with them on the ground there, and then either you're sent by the academy or the club or the association out, or the player hires you. So that's the highway for coaches to get on the tour these days. But getting on the tour, whether it's the junior or the futures or the challenger tour, is not the hard part. It's staying out there and then being successful out there. And we see a lot of people who are one and done. They get one player, and then they're done. And so, but once you get there, then, of course, you want to be able to do something. So I suggest reading as many tennis books as you can, and to keep continuously improving your education. So, you know, Rod Laver's Education of a Tennis Player is a great one. Bill Tilden's old classic, Match Play and the Art of Spin. But you've got to be hungry and you've got to ask questions. And if you're not a reader, then you've got to go up to established coaches and ask if you can just go on the court with them and pick up balls while they train. But you've got to be hungry to learn if you're going to make it on the tennis tour. Not getting on the tour is easy. We've got girlfriends of players wearing coaches' badges. But staying on the tour and making a difference is the challenge.
Yeah, it's really, really true. I remember when you were first in coaching, I was with you in Indianapolis, the old RCA hard court tournament, and I remember Rod Laver being there, and everybody goes, oh my gosh, here's Rod Laver. And you, as about a 23 or 24-year-old, walked right over to Rod Laver, and you said, Mr. Laver, I'm a young coach. Could I speak to you for a moment? And that was a shocker, and that was, I said, this guy is hungry to be an excellent coach.
Well, if I had to pick one thing that's helped my career the most, it's been fortunate to have mentors and then people take an interest in helping me. And not, you know, as you get older, you realize as a coach, you want to help those people who are willing to help themselves. And I see some coaches coming out there, you know, willing to ask questions and learn. But a great story coach is Pat Echeverry. Pat Echeverry has been in the champions box of more Grand Slams than anybody I know of, men and women. He's been there, but yet, you know, a lot of times he's not, you know, people don't go up to him anymore and ask him for advice or to tell stories. And, you know, you learn just as much in the locker room as you do in these fancy teaching courses. And it's in the locker room where you hear the backstories, and you're able to ask questions from the established coaches like Tony Roach and others. So that's if there's a secret, it's you know, not being too afraid to ask questions and ask for help.
I mean, and most people, if they're a bad person, they're not going to, they'll blow you off. But almost everybody, I remember Rod Laver sitting there with you for 30 minutes. It's really an incredible thing. You know, in 1980, I was in the audience at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York, and I've said this many times on the program. The question was asked of the great Clarence Mabry, who was the coach at Trinity University, one of my idols. And they said, Coach Mabry, some guy said, what is the most important quality of a championship tennis player? And he sort of scratched his chin and he goes, most definitely, I believe it is the hunger of an inquisitive mind, the kind of mind that asks questions. How do I get better? What do I do next? What do I do on my backhand? Hey, why did he win that match? Why did this happen? Why did that happen? And you know, it is incredibly profound answer, I think.
Yeah, well, you see it, there's some coaches come out there, they just can't get enough of watching matches, and they're taking notes, and they're video, and we see it just about, there's always one person, one young coach, or one person who wants to be a coach. So a lot of times it's a parent with a child who's playing, and you can just, you know, like the old saying, your actions speak so loud, and I hear your words, they just radiate that desire to learn and absorb and take it in. You know, a lot of people give John Tomic, his father, you know, they have a negative impression of him. Bernard Tomic, Father John, but John was a taxi driver in Australia, immigrant from the war in Bosnia, and he wanted his son to play tennis, and he read every single tennis book that he could get, watched every single video, and his son's top 20 in the world, his daughter is about 400, and John is a self-taught tennis coach. His knowledge of tennis is incredible. Same with Paderborn Sri Chapan's father. You know, so you, in this day and age, coach, if you want to learn how to coach. Kevin Anderson's dad. It goes on and on. There's no excuse for not knowing today with all the information that's available.
Yeah, but the hunger, the more information we have, we sometimes lose our hunger. So that's just fascinating stuff. So thank you for that. I want to go somewhere else now, though. I want to ask you, I really believe your legacy is going to be more than in the United States, more than in Europe. It's going to be in Southeast Asia and Asia. You really have made a big footprint there in Southeast Asia. You know, I think of a Harry Hopman, the footprint he made all over the world. Here in the United States, of course, he had impact. But I think Harry Hopman, I've heard stories about a Welby Van Horn, the impact he made in India with the beautiful strokes and things. You always see the Indians with such beautiful strokes. Your impact is going to be a great one for what you're doing now. Folks, Robert started a program, I think it's been nearly 10 years ago, in Cambodia, called From Killing Fields to Tennis Courts. And you can go to that, Cambodia Tennis, From Killing Fields to Tennis Court. They will tell the story. It's about a 22-minute CNN Asia video. It's a beautiful, beautiful story about getting tennis going again in Cambodia after the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot and everything, basically the genocide that happened early. It was 1970, right around the 1970, Vietnam War was on and everything, but people did not give it, nobody knew about it much, and actually Pol Pot never got prosecuted, and he went to China and died and things. But Robert, could you talk about that a little bit, because it's really fascinating.
Well, I don't think that I started as much as I went there and just sort of stumbled on a story. And I wrote a story in the Bangkok Post called Killing Fields Tennis Courts. And it picked up traction in different medias. And then with that, the Rititep, who is president of the tennis
association. Right, Rititep, and that's real important. He has been the anchor there always for many, many years.
So then a lot of people around the world started asking questions and coming in, and so he had the program. But the concept is to build tennis courts in areas that used to be full of landmines, and so putting a lot of kids back out playing, kids and adults, in areas that have been demined, and utility courts have put up, but also recognizing that Cambodia had a really good tennis going on in the late 60s and 50s. They were very competitive.
History was very competitive, right.
And it wasn't until the Civil War and then the genocide. But they picked up the pieces. They're going forward. They're doing great now. They've got a lot of projects for orphans and then also for those survivors who were affected. So that has gone well. But with the work in Southeast Asia, Coach, I think it's time for us to recognize that, you know, in third world countries, you get a lot of Western influence from Australia, from America, from Europe coming over, and they're become the expert. But there's a big discrimination between pay from the local coaches and the foreign experts. But now Southeast Asia has had so many good players who made it to the ATP and WTA, and and done well, that they are now coming back and taking over the coaching. So what I would like to see is the Asian coaches get the similar opportunity to show what they can do.
Could you talk about that? For example, Thailand, you have the Roddy Tuwana brother. Go ahead.
Well, you have Thanakorn Srichapan, who is the older brother of Potadorn, who was on the tour for several years with him, and on a first-name basis with Agassi and Safin and Sampras and all the players that Potadorn used to practice with. And he's obviously got a wealth of information and experience. Danai Udomchok, who got to about 75 ATP singles, did very well on the tour. He's now coaching the number two Asian player, Randy Liu. The Thai twins, the Ratiwatana brothers, are at the end of their career and they're phasing.
Sonchai and Sonchai.
They're coaching. We have others in Indonesia, but the point of it is we want to let the Asian coaches have an opportunity to show what they can do. Now, if they're not up to the task, that's on them. But too many times, myself included, we're put on a pedestal. But let me tell you, foreign coaches in developing countries are there for one reason, and that's because of the money or the lifestyle. And as Danai Udomchok told me, if things don't go well, he's got nowhere else to go. He has to make it work in Southeast Asia. And I see with the Asian coaches, the quality that I like the most about them is the care factor. They care about developing tennis in their countries.
That's the same in every country, though.
Yeah.
That's the same. I've often said, when you get to coach at your alma mater, you give blood a little bit deeper. It's not that you don't try, but you give your blood. If you work in your hometown, in your neighborhood, the loyalty there. But that's absolutely truthful. You know, here in the United States, I think that we have groups of coaches that really want to see the United States tennis take back off. But you're saying, so Danai, I've seen him out there on the Pro Tour. Fantastic man, and what a giver. The Ratitawana brothers, fantastic human beings. So
get the opportunity.
That's right.
And I think they are. We're seeing now that it's more to being the coaching than just having a ranking or being on the tour. And there's also a lot of cultural sensitivities you need to be aware of, especially in Asia. Asia is unlike any other place where it's not just about going on the court, working a player out. You've got to spend a lot of time off the court, knowing how to show respect, give respect, and it's something that many of us Western coaches either don't know or don't want to learn.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Talk real quickly about Assam Qureshi. You've been with him 15 years?
15 years.
15 years, best results. Finals, U.S. Open doubles in 2010, losing a tight match to the Bryan brothers in the finals. And then same year, finals of U.S. Open mixed doubles. He's been as high as number two in the world? Number eight in the world in doubles. I thought they got up there one time. He was with Rogier.
Jean-Julien Rogier.
But he's 37 years old and still playing. That's a great tribute. Well, first of all, we haven't heard of a lot of Pakistani players that have the Rahim brothers years and years ago.
With Assam, it's been a wonderful journey. He's a great example that you can be a wonderful person and a wonderful player. And Assam's greatest strength is he's always put others before himself. And he has a foundation, Stop War, Start Tennis, that he uses the platform of Pro Tennis to help purchase wheelchairs that are used for wheelchair tennis and send them to areas that have been affected by war zones. Assam does a lot of charity work at hospitals and schools. It's been interesting. The thing that may have hurt him a little bit early on was there were no pro players out of Pakistan. So he had to basically, him and his family had to blaze a trail on their own and pioneer. And, you know, they didn't know what it was like to go from ITF juniors to the pro. So there was basically trial and error. But he's done very well. He made four straight ATP World Tour finals, two with Bopan and two with Rogier. He's won a lot of things, but I'm not so sure if the results are what defines him. It's his qualities as a person, what he's trying to do with what tennis has given him, that I think is greater than any trophy he's ever lifted.
So his charity is called Stop Wars, Play Tennis.
Stop Tennis, and he's had that for many years, about 8 years now. But Qureshi is a Muslim, and he made the quarterfinals of Wimbledon with an Israeli, Amir Haddad. He's played with an Indian, which everyone knows India and Pakistan have a lot of issues.
Baggage, yeah.
So Assam is a big thing. Is he believes sports and politics shouldn't be mixed, and he's just a great example of someone who, a great ambassador for tennis. I'll leave it at that.
Well, we've only got a few minutes, 3-4 minutes, but and we've covered all of my notes. And Robert, I'd like to ask you for yourself, what are your goals now? What are you thinking? How does this translate into the next 10 to 15 years of your life? If you could give us if you had a paintbrush and you could, what would be your perfect scenario in the next 10 to 15 years?
Well, I'd like to finish some of these book projects. The one on the Bryan brothers is an awesome opportunity, but it's also a heavy burden to write something that honors what they've contributed to tennis. Another book that I've been working on is one with conversations with coaches and who've helped players do well at the Grand Slams, and it's a lot of fun and I'm learning. But I suppose, Coach, as you taught us to honor the game, I would like to help more coaches and more teachers to get them on the right pathway, as well as leaving, if you talk about leaving a mark, it have to be in the form of books and manuals and
right.
curriculums.
What would be the traps, real quick, the traps to watch out for a young coach coming up? What are the traps that knock you off the horse?
That's a great question. I can answer that very easily. It's vanity is number one. I mean, I tell you what, the worst thing that can happen is for a young coach to start thinking he's got special. There's no magic out there. And, always you can tell a coach if he's on the right track. A good coach never says we when discussing a win. But he does say we when talking about a loss. And, you see that all the time. Young coaches come out, or even older coaches say, we did this and we did that. But then they say the player lost. And, like you always taught us, praise in public, critique in private. Never badmouth your player. You see, this is probably one of the biggest mistakes with coaches. They get out there, but the player gave them an opportunity. When things don't go well, they start badmouthing the player behind his back. You've got to stay loyal to the person who brought you to the arena. That one. And then, of course,
dance with the one that brought you.
Yeah. But the biggest thing that I think that is lacking for young coaches and others, everybody needs a boss. And when you're on the tour, you don't really have a boss. You don't have someone that's saying, hey, I think maybe you could do this better, or you might try that, or maybe you're making a mistake here. So for the young coach, you go through it, years go by, and you lose the sense of accountability.
I think that the accountability, again, this is not the mentoring program, but everybody needs a teacher, everybody needs a student, but we need that same level person that holds us accountable to a higher level, and we call it a Paul, a Barnabas, a Timothy, but we need those Barnabases, are those best friends that will tell us the truth. But so, Robert, I cannot thank you enough for being on the program today, and this is going to be a program that I hope many of you will go back and listen to again and again. And it's out there, folks, on the UR Tennis Network, and we wanted to thank Robert.
Made in America. Never buy a tattooed on his Simpsons. Spend a little more in the store for a tag in the back of this USA. Won't buy nothing that he can't fix. With WD-40 and a Craftsman wrench, he ain't president. He's just America.
I'd like to thank Robert Davis. Thank you very much, Robert, for being on the program today.
Thanks, Coach. It's always fun.
And we'd like to remind you that you're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or a loss. God bless you, and we will see you next week on American Tennis.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.